Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, and today we're going to be talking with you a bit about dormant oils. When the heck do you use dormant oils? Well, a lot of people use them to control insects on their plants, and we're going to be talking about using dormant oils today with our guest, Phil Pelletieri. Phil's been with us for a long, long time, entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus. He retired as head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Man, it hardly seems possible. That was in 2014, so that's almost about five years ago. But he still stops by every other month or so to talk about insects. And we can talk about those dormant oils, and we can also talk about maybe some insects that may be invading your home, or maybe that invaded your garden last summer, or maybe your trees or your shrubs. Give a call at 1-800-642-1234. Lots of times when Phil is on, we get some great photos. Maybe sometimes people want to know maybe what is eating up their leaves, or maybe they have an insect that they've gotten a great shot of. They want Phil to identify, and we can do that too. Just email us at ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Phil Pelletieri, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Nice to be here.
So, dormant oils. I've mentioned the term about five times already, and I probably should have done a little bit more about what it is, and you're better at it than I am. So tell us, what is dormant oil?
Well, the true dormant oils are kind of an old strategy, and what you do is you treat plants before they leaf out in the spring with an oil that will suffocate any insect that's trying to spend the winter on the tree. Mm-hmm. So it's usually in the egg stage, some cases larvae. So the first thing to see if it fits is whatever your insect headache, something like a Japanese beetle, this would have absolutely no effect on because they're grubs in the ground at that time. They're not, we're talking aphids and scales and the like. The true dormant oils basically are petroleum-based. The problem with them is if the plant is growing, the oils will burn the leaves. This is in contrast to what we call summer weight or horticulture oils that some people have been using, and they've become quite a bit more popular in the last 10 to 15 years because they're quite a bit less toxic than some of the other alternatives. But they tend to be too light. They don't stick long enough to suffocate the insect on the plant. The other thing about dormant oils and why this is kind of a good time to at least consider it is that they have to be used when the temperature is above freezing but before the plant's growing. So usually you're talking into March, maybe early April is appropriate time. And by far, I think the biggest use is typically been on fruit trees, for various scale insects and aphids that growers have. But in general, I think there is less of this kind of strategy than, as I said, it was when I started my career.
So what does it, suffocate the eggs?
Is that literally, they can't breathe through it. And so it is highly effective as long as the critters are exposed. And the oils tend to be very highly refined. I mean, this is not motor oil type stuff. They got to get a lot of the impurities out of there because those tend to be what are toxic to the plants.
And how have they changed over the years?
Well, as I said, people have been looking at other oils, and there's a lot of plant-based oils now that are sold for controlling aphids and scales and especially soft-bodied insects. But those are what we call summer oils that are, kind of a contact kill, and they won't burn the plants. But as I had mentioned, they just don't have the kind of residual to really work as a true dormant oil would.
And the true dormant oil then probably for orchard situations?
Yeah, maybe? I mean, that's typically, there might be some plants in your landscape, especially if you had scale insects. It's a great strategy for scales because most scales overwinter as eggs on the plant. They're exposed, they're out in the open. And the oils are very effective and you can get to them. The problem when a plant leaves out is sometimes coverage. You just can't get the stuff through the leaves to where the critters are hiding, so.
That makes a lot of sense. What about residual effects? Are there any that hang around?
Generally not. And as I said, because they're highly refined oils, they've got a lot of the impurities out. Some are paraffin-based. As I said, there's been quite a few. They tend to be a little pricey to get the real good pure ones because they have to go through a lot of stages. And as I said, it's an interesting technology, but you got to do your homework to make sure the critter you're fighting is going to be available at that time. You treat in March, and it gets a little tricky with the weather because you'd like it above freezing. That causes the insects to respirate more, which makes them more susceptible.
Does it wash off? I mean, if you...
Oh, yeah. It's not real thick. It's not staining.
So you're not going to do it before a heavy rainstorm is predicted.
Yeah, well, that's kind of in general with most sprays.
Yeah.
You know, the rain, you might as well start from ground zero again.
Phil Pelletieri, our guest today, UW Extension Specialist in the area of insects. Retired now, but comes back every couple of months to talk with us. Questions for Phil, maybe about sprays, maybe about insects, other insects that may be bugging you, so to speak. Give a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. And let's take a couple of emails and calls here. Kim near Eau Claire called in a few minutes ago to ask about stink bugs. She's seeing all kinds of stink bugs in her house in Eau Claire. How does she get rid of them?
Well, the first thing, I share her pain. This is one of the reasons Phil retired, because we saw this one coming. So the problem has been this Asian stink bug. It's called the brown marmorated stink bug. First started in the Philadelphia area about 15 years ago. It's migrated in the state. We had our first records a couple years before I retired. And its claim to fame in the fall is it invades houses, spends the whole winter as an adult in, you know, secluded places. And then when you get warm days, some wake up and kind of come into your living space. So you really can't get to where they're hiding right now. So sprays, honestly, I'm not really excited about. You might as well just pick them up with a shop vac or whatever.
Right.
But we know they come in the fall. And so the two strategies is, one, if all possible, the best strategy is to figure out what they're squeezing into and seal it up. And that is tough, but I, you know, where we get the dilemma is an old farmhouse that is just so leaky, it is going to be physically impossible to tighten it up enough to stop them. But sometimes it's a pattern. If they all show up in the bathroom, then my first thought is that the bathroom vent fan probably is not caulked or screened in a way, and it makes easy access for the insect. So, you know, tightening things up before, I would say, the second week of September, because that's when they start rummaging around and start migrating in. Other strategy then, and this is the same we use for Asian lady beetles and cluster flies, is there are sprays that can be applied to the outside of the house at that time, again, to intercept them before they get in.
Right.
I will tell you, this insect is harder to kill than the other two. And so people have been a little disappointed. And some of this has always been a numbers game. I mean, if you've got 10,000 trying to come in, and I'm not exaggerating, if you look at what's happened out east, they have experienced those kind of invasions. So you kill 99% of them. As an entomologist, I'm excited, but, you know, great control. But you still got hundreds in your house. And so, as I said, the dilemma as this continues to intensify is this is going to be more problematic, I suspect, for at least the next 5 to 10 years. And then hopefully maybe things will start to wind down, because that's kind of the pattern of invasive things, that they get better over time.
Phil Pelletieri, our guest. Let's take some calls. Vicki in Cary, Illinois. It's your turn. Hi, Vicki.
Hi. I love your show. I'm always happy when I find it on the radio.
Thank you.
So I have a question about scale. I know you were just talking about outdoor scale, which I have a problem inside. Somehow in the last few years or so, probably a plant that somebody gave me had a little scale on it. I have it on my orange jasmine plant. I have it on my orchids. And I've been just using alcohol on a Q-tip or cotton ball and just, you know, painstakingly going through the plant, doing what I can. The orange jasmine is like a bush in my house. It's gotten quite big. I've pruned it all the way back and let it come back in the summer, which really helped. But with the orchids, I can't do that. And I want to get rid of these things. This scale is so difficult.
Right. Yeah. And part of it is just they have life stages that are not available. They're kind of mixed in egg stage and immatures and adults. And so most treatments you do only take one life stage out. And so what they use on a lot of plants are either insecticidal soaps or, again, some of those lightweight oils that we talked about. Or if you were to use a traditional insecticide, really the strategy is the same, is that for scales, a minimum of 3 treatments, you used to be about 10 to 12 days apart. So what you're doing is you're bleeding the population out. The other problem on that larger plant is coverage, because if there's corners you don't get to, conceivably, a sack of eggs could be there and they're right back at you. And so, you know, it's probably a little easier to treat the plants in the summer, where you can take the plants outside and really give them a good washing. Some people I know put them in the tub and attack them that way. With the orchids, it'd probably be a little easier. But then the dilemma, whether you're using the soaps or the oils, is when you have a diversity of potential plants and treatments, some treatments don't get along with certain plants.
Yeah.
It's kind of a personality disorder if you look at it. And, you know, orchids in general tend to have far less scale problems than most of the tropical plants that we bring in. So we never really got a lot of those. But I think the thing about an orchid is most of the stuff should be available. So what I would consider is buying some of this insecticidal soap that you can get at the, you know, local plant store. And I think what I would do, just to be cautious, is because soap kills on contact. You know, get a plant mister, mist the plants very well. And then after about 10 minutes, I would rinse the plant off. What you're doing is getting rid of the soap residues that most likely would cause the phytotoxicity. It doesn't affect how it works because soap only kills on contact. There's no residual about it. And so if you treat, come back about 2 weeks later, come back a third time 2 weeks later, that should cover the bases well enough that you have eliminated the critters. The other thing is, you know, probably makes sense if you got your orchids, you can isolate the infected plants from the uninfected, so you just kind of concentrate on it. I'm not sure I would mess with, again, because I don't find the scales on orchids overly aggressive, I would mess with plants that don't show me any signs of critters.
All right. Vicki, I hope that helps. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And let's see, let's take another call. How about Frank in Menominee? Frank, you're up. Thanks for calling.
Hi. 41 degrees below zero in my backyard 2 weeks ago. I have beautiful ash trees, I expect them to die with this emerald ash borer. And I heard the temperature may affect those ash borers. Fill me in on that.
Yeah, so research back about 4 or 5 years ago up in northern Minnesota gave us at least a glimmer of hope. And the magic temperature is getting between 25 and 30 below. And they found, you know, where that's often a temperature that they see, that they expect that to really slow down ash borer far north. I was always a little hesitant down here because we rarely see those temperatures. And even with the craziness, we're approaching 30 below in Madison. I think it's going to help. I just don't think it was enough, long enough. And so 41, that's impressive. As I said, I think you can expect quite a bit more mortality, but I'm not so sure. Put it this way, this is not the end of the ash borer. It just depends. If this kind of climate effect happens on a regular basis or you expect it, that will keep the ash borer from really going great guns. But I think in Wisconsin, I think from Wausau south, typically, we just don't see those temperatures and seem to see them far less than we did, you know, 40 or 50 years ago. And so, you know, it's nice when we get them, but it really, I don't think in the long run is going to be the saving grace that we need.
Unfortunately.
Yeah.
You know, as you were talking, I was thinking about Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, because I visit up there playing a golf tournament there in the spring, and all of the elm trees there remind me so much of Madison, the old photos of Madison back from the 40s and 50s, even. Even the 60s, yeah, even the 60s. They haven't lost all their elm trees because the elm bark beetle, I assume it's the reason being, it can't stand the winter, or hasn't been able to yet.
Yeah, I mean, insects can evolve over time, but they really don't tend to evolve very quickly when you're talking about these kind of temperature extremes. And so there is some blessing being farther north.
Definitely.
At least that's what you tell yourself in the winter. So.
Okay. Frank, thanks. Appreciate the call. On to Steve in Madison next. Hi, Steve.
Morning. I have a question about our Macintosh apple tree that we planted in our backyard a long time ago. We have wonderful harvests of apples, but they're always infested with something that we've been told is called codling moth. And I'm wondering if there is an appropriate insecticide for it, when it should be applied, and will it help?
Could you describe what happens with the apples? Do they scab?
They have big holes in them, and something looks like a pencil drilled through it?
Yeah. Okay. And there's always something growing in the core of the apple.
Okay. the reason I ask, I mean, apples, if you look at a list of critters in what that eat apples, it's over 100. I mean, they are just highly susceptible, and that's why on a commercial scale people are spraying multiple times, because it's just wave after wave. But what you find is that, you know, the first wave comes on when the petals fall off the plant. That's a little early for codling moth. Honestly, it's a little bit later coming on because what's happening is it's laying its eggs on the small apples, and then little larvae burrow in and go down through the seeds and stuff and cause problems. So interesting enough, there's some pretty scientifically technical ways. You know, in orchards, one of the things that they played around with is a confusion technique where they use the mimicked pheromone of the female to confuse the males so that they don't mate. And if they don't mate, they can't lay eggs and the like. And mm-hmm. so, you know, people have been looking at less toxic or more environmentally friendly have used that technique. I think that's a little bit more than you expect a homeowner to go after. The nice thing is that there's a couple products that both would fit both organic and people who, you know, don't necessarily need organic products. The insecticide spinosad, I know it as Dr. Jack's Dead Bug Brew, there are other products out there, is an organic-based insecticide that is highly effective on caterpillars. And it turns out that I would expect if you've got this Dr. Jack's or, you know, various products on the small fruit as it develops, the little critters will feed on it and they will die. And so I think that's the way to go. I don't have my spray schedule in front of me. I'm guessing the first codling moth spray is probably going on the 1st of June, but that'll be worth looking up because, as you said, there's so many critters. Sometimes I have a hard time balancing the calendar as much as I used to back in the day. So that would be the first application. There is another wave of codling moth that can come in towards the end of July. So if things are atrociously bad, but I would just give the springish treatment first and see if that's enough. Another thing you can do in general to reduce things if you've got some young ones around is make it a game of picking up all your windfall apples, because the trick so many insects use is that the apple falls to the ground and they will burrow out of the apple and go in the ground to complete their life cycle. And by the sanitation, you honestly can head some of that off at the pass. Now, what makes life a little difficult is that so many of our apple-infesting insects also feed on crab apples and wild apples, and so there's always a reserve. Although codling moth's a little more specialized. I mean, you don't see it on crab apples and the like. It's basically a big fruit type of pest.
Yeah. There we go. Thank you so much, Steve. Appreciate your call. Phil Pelletieri, our guest today, entomologist extraordinaire, as a matter of fact. I'm Larry Mueller. Dave Botratz, our engineer, Jill Nadol, our producer, and you are listening to the Ideas Network. We're taking a look at the world of insects today here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus, headed the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Questions for him, you can call us at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us a question, and if you've got a photo, you can email that as well to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And let's go to Augusta next and talk with Bob. Bob, hi. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. I appreciate you taking my call.
Sure thing. What's on your mind?
Well, it's more on my wife's mind than my mind, but we seem to have got a number of carpenter ants that are coming into the house. Okay. And I've listened to the program before when Phil has talked about, you know, a tree outside or someplace like that may have the nest in them. But when it was 40 below here, we still had them. We'd get probably 10 ants a day.
Okay, that's impressive.
That's a lot.
You know, the game we always play is where are the ants coming from, and at this time of the year, there's only one source, and it's not just the house. It's away from all outside walls. I would assume your walls are too cold for the ants to be active, and so wherever they are nesting, it is maintaining a temperature above 50 to 55 degrees. So that might be helpful. What happens when they wake up now is they think it's spring for whatever reason, and they're probably more interested in water than they are food. So you might see them around the sink, or if you know got dishes that have some water on them, or in the bathroom. And here is where it gets a little tricky in that, you know, the game I always would tell people, you find the nest and treat it and you're done, and then we hang up the phone and I haven't really answered your question because you often don't know where the nest is. But the two things you can consider is there are baits, And the ants will start having an interest in baits within the next couple, 3 weeks because they're going to start raising young. And that's when they need the food reserves to bring in. The thing about baits is that really the best baits are not available easily. They're not at the local hardware store. You have to get on the internet and order them from some of these do-your-own pest control companies, and there's a number of them there. These are the kind of baits that commercial people would use, and it's a marketing decision. It's not because they're more toxic. It's just that they tend to market it to professional people and not so much to homeowners. You can try some of the baits you get at the hardware store. The success is how much interest the ants have. And generally speaking, the ants have more of an interest in a protein-based bait early, and when we get into the middle and late summer, they need more sugar-based things for their energy reserves. So that's one thing to consider. And the one thing about baits is you provide them for as long and probably twice as long as you think you need, because what happens is if they work, the workers pick it up, they start feeding the queen, and that's the trick here. If we kill the queen, the colony cannot survive. There's no way that they could reproduce. And so it's how much bait gets in there. The queen does not see a new food source right away. I mean, it's too risky if you think about it evolutionary-wise. Yeah. And so sometimes people get a little bit of excitement. They see them. What you start to pick up, though, quite quickly is if they're accepting the bait, you're going to start to find some dead ants or some very lethargic ants. Most of the stuff you get at the hardware store is boric acid-based. And they'll either use a sweet or an oil type thing. To be honest, the internet available baits have some other products that are involved. Not so much, I think that the toxicant is that much better, but the baits have been researched and formulated that they kind of fit the needs of the carpenter ant a little bit better than just a sugar-based, honey bait or something like that. So now's the time to get after them. The next 3 months, I'd say, is your big win, especially the next 2 months. And as I said, if it's any help, sometimes I tell people, and they laugh at me, but you trail the ants. If you see a pattern and an ant's walking and it starts crawling up the ceiling, that gives you a hint where the nest is going to be. I mean, he's not going to crawl on the ceiling unless there's a reason. And so sometimes people will just put out, not a bait, but put out some sugar on a plate. They're more active at night than they are in the day. So, it's you come here at 10 o'clock and you watch where the ants are going. And what you want to see is the old picnic line of ants coming and going, and try to trace that back. Because if you see the spot, I would tell you, 2 squirts of any ant spray will solve the problem if it's in the right spot. But they're often hidden. It's often without quite a bit of detective work, hard to pin down where they're coming from.
So the baits that you were talking about that you get online, what do you look for as an ingredient
name? The companies will identify them as carpenter ant baits. There's an avermectin bait, and as I said, there's 3 or 4 of them that are on the market that really have worked quite well. And as I said, to me, the interesting thing has not been the active ingredient, because there's a number of those things that will work. It is a bait that is made, and the more generalized an ant bait is, the less they're targeting this one species that we're after. So.
Okay, so you look for one that targets carpenter ants.
And as I said, I found these websites to be really quite educational. They're pretty good at giving people options. And if that doesn't work, there's other things that we can go down the line. But I'm a big proponent of baits. If they work, they work very well. And as I said, the one question we can answer right away for you is we know the ants are nesting indoors. There's no way an outside ant could be active. And I do not see. Typically, ants at this time have to be in the warm spot of the house. When they start showing up the last week of March, that's when I think of the outside walls and the roof, because they're finally warming up enough to get the ants going. So whereas the outside ants, we don't see coming until early May.
They might
be
in the ceiling then.
Yes. In common, you often see the ants in weakened wood. I mean, the mistake we made of using carpenter ant as the common name is they do not eat wood. They nest in softened wood or other soft substrates. But if you've got a rotten windowsill, the ants move in and you find that there's ants in the windowsill, you tend to blame them for ruining the windowsill, not understanding this is just a normal evolution of a decay process and the ants are taking advantage of it.
Yeah. So, Bob, there you go. I hope that helps. Appreciate your call very much. Thank you. And Tom in Neenah, Wisconsin, we go to you next. Hi, Tom.
Hi. It's good to hear of alternatives to pesticides. I had an experience in our backyard. I had 2 white pines. They were probably 10 feet tall, and they had a pine sawfly infestation. And online, I was able to identify all four life stages. And then I could go out to the trees and with a stepladder go around and remove the eggs, the pupa, and the larva. Well, certainly not the flying adults. But over a period of 2 years, we were able to totally eradicate the infestation. And there's such good information online that, you know, I think people can go out there and search and find out how to identify some of the pests and just use the mechanical means of eradication.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, the one thing with that particular insect is it tends to have cycles. And so you often find that under normal conditions, their natural enemies do the control for us, and we just don't witness there's a problem. When things get kind of out of sync, that's when we get these outbreaks. And, you know, in general, handpicking is an option. There's some insects that will overwhelm you. We know with Japanese beetle, you can handpick all you want, and you get 50% at best. And because they're flying in from away, so you really don't have control of the situation. What could have happened for you if there's not that many white pines around, you had the whole population in front of you, and so you can see where you can have a bigger impact with that. But yeah, you know, well before insecticides were developed,
people had to battle the battles,
and, you know, handpicking and mechanical means were available. You know, it was interesting to watch people using vacuum cleaners and other things. You know, when we first got into the organic productions in a heavier scale, there weren't many products available. There have been more products been developed now that fit organic standards. But again, I remember these giant vacuums, they'd go into the strawberry beds trying to dislodge the insects, and it worked to a pretty good degree.
Yeah. Tom, I appreciate the call. Thank you so much. And Jackie in Milwaukee will give you a chance. Hi, Jackie.
Hi.
What can we do for you today?
Well, somebody gave me an orchid. I put it with the other orchids, and now they all have spider mites.
Oh.
Now, I have washed them. I have sprayed them twice now with Dawn soap, but they do eventually come back.
Okay. Much like the discussion we had earlier with the person who had the scale thing, spider mites give you the same headache in that they have egg stages that are really not very susceptible. And so it's as much a timing. I'm a little surprised. Now, you know, spider mites are the number one pest of anything in California when it's hot and dry. And what happens in the winter in our houses, the humidity's dropped, so we've got kind of California-like conditions. But usually there's enough humidity around. I don't find them as successful on orchids as I do other plants. But if they're going after you, it's a battle. I still prefer the normal insecticidal soaps instead of the home remedies. And this goes back to years ago, Larry and I were doing a show, yeah. And one of my colleagues in Iowa State, his favorite technique for killing box elder bugs was Tide detergent. And somebody called in and said, I tried Cheer and it didn't work. Well, what it comes down to is when you use store-bought and soaps, I don't know what's in there. And it turns out we know that there's certain fatty acids that are effective as insecticides. That's what's in the insecticidal soap. The other problem with the home remedies is they have whiteners, brighteners, perfumes, other things that sometimes are phytotoxic. So you're usually safer if you're going to use a product that is an insecticidal soap that doesn't have those products. If the Dawn worked for you, that's fine, but it's always a trial and error. But the other part of this with spider mites, it's again, probably two, maybe three treatments, 2 weeks apart. That way you allow the eggs to hatch. You kill the young spider mites before they have a chance to lay another batch of eggs. And where you may have been off, if your timing wasn't quite right, some of them could have matured and started the next generation before you went after them. Plus, there were already eggs still sitting there. So as I said, it always takes multiple treatments at relatively tight time schedules to beat this, what I consider a whole indoor wave of tropical things, you know, the scales,
yeah,
some of the aphids and spider mites.
Yeah. So good luck, Jackie. You're looking at two or three treatments here, probably, at least a couple. And
right. And you could probably, with spider mites, because of this moisture issue, some people just wash the plants once a week. And, you know, and that probably would help a bit, although the soap is a little better at killing them than just washing them. So I think there's an advantage to the soaps.
Thanks, Jackie. Appreciate it. Tricia in Fond du Lac, on to you. Hi, Tricia.
Hi.
What's on your mind today?
Well, I used to have a wonderful patch of raspberries that gave me so much fruit. I would have bags and bags in the freezer. over the years, more and more of those Japanese beetles are attacking them, and last summer was horrible, and I barely got any to eat. I've always tried to stay away from anything that, you know, would make it harmful to eat the berries, but after last year, I've decided I've got to do something, so any help would be appreciated.
Do you have a big patch of berries?
I do, yes.
So
yep, it runs the length of my deck and around the house, and okay. I have another patch off to the side, too, but the patch that's near the house is infested more.
Okay.
Okay. Do the canes show any sign of disease problems, too? Japanese beetles have an impact, but when you start having such a significant decline, I get a little nervous that there might be some cane blights and other things that are, causing complications.
No, it appears healthy. The canes look healthy.
Okay, good. Okay. So, you know, on a smaller scale, to be honest, I'm more of a fan of physical barriers, if possible, but with plants this spread out, that's not going to work. The dilemma with Japanese beetle is, first of all, they're not breeding on your property, so there's nothing I can tell you can do to your grass and stuff that really is going to make a significant difference. You know they're going to start showing up last few days of June and then well into July, and then you've got 2 months of misery. And whatever I suggest to you is going to give you about 5 to 7 days of relief. We've played around on the organic side with neem oil. Again, the spinosad product that's out there. There's been a couple interesting bacteria products in development, but I just haven't seen them hit the market yet. All of those, though, would be kind of applied the same way as you apply them, or if you were using a more traditional fruit tree spray or fruit spray, you would apply them when you see the first wave come on. And then, as I said, I would suggest probably about another 8 days, 7 days is apply again, and keep putting up the fight, trying to keep the leaves on the plant as these things continue to migrate in. Now, the other side of it that, you know, I've often talked about in my own experience with Japanese beetle is back around 2000, it was bordering on a science fiction movie in my neighborhood. I mean, we didn't have any birch trees that had leaves on, and crab apples and purple leaf plums. And, you know, again, these things
grapes.
Eat so many things. Yeah. You want to find an indicator plant. And I live about a block from a golf course, and we knew that that's where many of these were migrating from. And now, you know, almost 20 years later, there isn't even a tenth of the population. So it will get better over time. But my warning always when I talk to Japanese beetles, and it's still kind of growing for people, is to realize that this will be one of the most dependable headaches you can have in the insect world for at least another 5 to 10 years. And so it's not if they're going to invade your raspberries again. It is, again, predictable when, and you will have to put up the fight. Now, the reason I was questioning a little bit about the performance of the plants is that, you know, sometimes we overreact to insect feeding. And, you know, a lot of studies have told us that you can lose 30% of your leaf tissue and normally not affect yields. It usually has to be above that kind of level. So a lot of it is really more cosmetic. But if you're comfortable that you don't see any diseases, that may explain it. The plant just can't get enough energy built in the plant that it can be very good at producing fruit the following year. So, as I said, the dilemma, it becomes high maintenance. And yeah. I wish I had an easier answer to that, but there isn't.
And if you wanted to fool around with it a bit, Phil, with, say, a few of your plants, maybe floating row covers?
Yeah, floating row covers. You know, Japanese beetles like plants out in the sun. They often... You know, you find it, they're often not even around in the morning, right away when you get up, and then they start flocking in. And there is this relationship that when they start feeding on plants, they give off volatiles that attract more Japanese beetles. Plus, at the same time, the females are giving off chemicals that are attracting the males. And I tell the story of my own battles. I just didn't want to spray, but they finally started attacking my azaleas, and that's a line you do not cross in my garden. And so when I put up the defense, I also sprayed some other plants that were having my potentillas in the front of the house were getting hit. And this was when the first wave came. And interesting enough, I didn't have to spray anymore. They all went to my neighbor's cotoneaster hedge and messed with that. And so you see this phenomenon that sometimes if you can lessen that first wave, the Japanese beetles will find something else to mess with and keep getting attracted to those plants. But the floating row covers are just, again, a nice physical barrier, and you're worrying more from them coming up above. Not, you don't worry the 6 inches down to the ground. You worry... Yeah. you know, the sunny sides and up high and see if you can physically keep them off the plants.
Tricia, does that help?
That is helpful. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. You can join in too, by the way. The number for you to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Jane in Adams up next. Hi, Jane.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question about spruce trees. I have the leader dying back on several spruce trees, and I'm wondering if this is an insect or if you have any ideas for what's causing the problem.
Sure. It's likely these relatively big trees, very small trees?
They're 10, 15 feet.
Okay. Seems a little big, but my guess, if it's critter-related, it's white pine weevil. And what happens is the female feeds into the leader, lays a number of eggs, and, of course, as the larvae feed, they girdle it, and it dies from that point above. Excuse me. The way you would confirm that is, you know, when you prune that out because it's dead, take a knife and slice just some of the surface off, and what you should see is a number of little cavities where the grubs have been. You know, the thing about this is if you catch it early enough before the critters have matured, unfortunately now they're adults and they're hiding in the leaf litter and the next wave will come next year. But if you can catch them when they're still grubs, you can physically prune it out and destroy it and thereby reduce the populations. The other thing is, unfortunately, is a spray that has to go on in the end of May, beginning of June, because that's when, you know, the new candles are coming out and that's when the weevils are starting this whole cycle. In smaller trees, there are some caterpillars that burrow into the shoots, but these sound too big. As I said, when I get leaders that are that big going out, usually it's white pine weevil.
Yeah.
And as I said, you may be able to physically beat it just by pruning and being a little bit more aggressive early, but if not, one of those applications would go. Now, the nice thing is, you know, it affects the shape of the tree somewhat, but it's never something that will kill. They're only attacking the new leaders, you know, and that's the only thing they'll mess with.
So good luck to you, Jane. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Again, 800-642-1234. Let's turn to Ann in Chippewa Falls. Hi, Ann.
Good morning, Larry. How are you?
Great. Appreciate your call. What's on your mind?
Well, you know, you were talking about Japanese beetles, and I've got to be one of the cheapest people around who refuse to buy anything or spray anything. And I noticed... I moved here from Virginia, but I don't think that really makes any difference. But I grew, just for the heck of it, just to see how it would look, bindweed up the side of my garage. And the Japanese beetles absolutely love it. And I noticed that they flew over all my raspberries. They flew over everything to attack that bindweed. So what I do in the afternoon... they get covered with it. It's a mess. And I go out and I either use a handheld vacuum cleaner or a little a can with you know, water and a little dish soap in it, and I just knock them off. And I collect like 30, 40, you know, till I'm tired of collecting them, they drop right in. And they don't attack anything else. They only go for the bindweed first.
Oh. Yeah,
they definitely have food preferences. If the numbers are still available, you know, what the research tells us is if you handpick, you reduce the population by 50% compared if you did not handpick. So you definitely make progress. It's just when they get crazy, what I find is everything that's susceptible they seem to eat. But it may just be you're not in a case where the populations can get that high. It's in general, it is more of an urban pest, and it usually is a pest where you have high maintained turf, where it's irrigated and the like. And that's why, you know, I don't want to pick on golf courses, but that's the ideal environment. And my colleague Chris Williamson, you know, would find as high as 60 to 70 grubs per square foot in ideal turf in some golf courses in Wisconsin. And to me, that number is mind-boggling. And then considering they fly for half a mile, you would just have wave after wave. If you're more isolated, there's probably less suitable. I mean, in my lawn, which is kind of a low-maintenance lawn, when I pull back the sod, I find about 1 or 2 per square foot, which is not enough to hurt the turf and definitely is not responsible for a lot of plant damage. So as I said, oftentimes people that have the worst misery, if they think about what's around them, they can usually find some high-maintained irrigated turf that is the biggest source of their problem.
And thanks so much. Appreciate your call very much. Phil Pelletieri, our guest today, entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I'm Larry Mueller. You are listening to the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller with my guest, Phil Pelletieri, distinguished faculty associate in entomology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Great to have him back. And certainly, if you have an insect question for him, or maybe you've got a photo, if you've got a photo, you can email it to ideas@wpr.org. You can also ask a question there. But call in, too. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Love to hear from you. Phil, we had somebody online who we lost had a comment or question about leaf bugs.
Yeah, so there's a critter, another one of these non-natives, although this happened to be from North America, called the Western Conifer Seed Bug. And it looks like a stink bug, and if you mess with it, it has a very distinct odor, so people often call it a stink bug. But normal stink bugs are shield-shaped, whereas these are more elongated. And the leaf bug family, leaf-footed bug family, the third pair of legs has kind of a flare to the leg. That's where the name comes from. Now, as the name conifer seed bug implies, they feed on the seeds of pine and spruce trees, and they also invade in the fall, but never the kind of numbers that you see with these new Asian stink bugs. So instead of, you know, you find 4 or 5 instead of 400 or 500 is kind of the difference. And so that reason, I don't really get all that concerned about it. And again, you kind of hand pick them. The other problem I used to see is people would go on the internet and they would look it up, and they would mistake this for some of the cone-nosed blood-feeding bugs that spread Chagas disease, which is a big human issue in South America. And they look very similar. I mean, if you had them next to each other, you could tell they're different insects, but again, without that reference. But we don't have cone-nosed bugs in Wisconsin that we worry about, so that's not to worry. But so if you only see a few things and they kind of more long and skinny, it's probably this Western conifer seed bug. Whereas I said, the traditional stink bug shape and kind of a brown marbled color is this Asian one that we've been worrying about.
Let's take another call. Trish in Madison, we'll go to you now. Hi, Trish. Thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Yeah. Hi, Larry and Phil. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
So I have ants in my yard. They burrow into my yard seemingly kind of deep because I get big piles of, like, dirt on the top of my lawn, and I just wondered how to get rid of them.
Okay, so that's typically, we call them field ants, and there's a handful of species. The technical genus is Formica, but what's interesting about their biology is those colonies live for 10 to 12 years. And the queen is quite deep. There's only one queen typically. So it's like carpenter ants. If we can get to that queen, we won the war. The problem is that she's deep enough in the ground that whatever you put on the surface probably isn't going to work. So what I normally suggest for these is get yourself a metal rod or pole and push down so you've got 3 or 4 channels, and you push them as far deep as you can. Then mix any insecticide that's registered for ants. You know, a lot of garden insecticides work. You might have to mix a dilute 1/2 gallon of product, but you pour it down those holes so it goes as deep as it can. It soaks deep in, and you're likely to get the queen in that case. And what I'll often do is kind of rake some of the soil away, do the poling and making of holes, treat, and then use that untreated soil to go over the top and cap it so I don't have any exposed insecticide. And it's a little labor intensive, but that works. Anything less than that, I think you're going to find disappointing. And as I said, the problem is if you spray on the top and then try to use water to wash it in, you don't go deep enough, whereas I think making those channels is what makes the difference.
And you think, what, 1 foot deep or 2 feet? Or?
Well, because the ants have been churning it, you'll often find that things are pretty loose. So it's really easy to push it down. And normally you're going 10 inches, maybe 15 inches.
Okay. Yeah. Trish, good luck. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, Carol in Wauwatosa has something for us. Hi, Carol.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Actually, this is about ants as well, but I'm having trouble. Even in February now, I'm getting all of a sudden little brown ants, and noticeably, like if there is like a piece of food got dropped, all of a sudden there's nothing, and then you turn around later and there's 20 or 30 of these little guys, and it's kind of gross.
Sure.
I don't know that they're in the house.
Oh, no, they have to be. They have to be. And if I had to take a wild guess, they're pavement ants from your description, which is a European ant that's moved in the last couple, 3 decades. And although they do quite well outside and nest outside, again, because of the timing of year and their activity, they're someplace that's warm, so they have to be nesting indoors. Little easier to bait than carpenter ants. I think what you have to pay attention to here is if they have are showing you a food preference. They might not, but they might prefer sweets. They might prefer protein. This ant does both. There's some ants that only do one. And then get yourself, a bait product and put it in the areas you're seeing activity. And again, even if the ants don't seem to be active, I'd leave the baits out at least for another week or two. And if they take it, what makes pavement ants a little more difficult is it's kind of a typical invasive ant, multiple queens. And so it's a little bit more difficult. But usually there aren't most of the nests we see indoors, they seem to have a preference for things that are kind of high humidity and warm. So, people that have hot water heat have a better environment than most of us do. So I don't think there's a lot of places in the house that they could be happy nesting in. And so what that suggests to me is that there's probably just one spot, and if you can get them accepting the bait, it will solve the dilemma for you. But just like carpenter ants, they really don't give you a lot of evidence of where they're nesting. And so it's better to bait them and let that take care of it. And a very interesting ant, just because, as I said, they can have these multiple queen colonies that, are kind of mind-boggling how many ants are involved with it. But if you can get that bait acceptance, it will solve any of those.
And thanks very much for calling. We had a listener send a photo of a bug, black, blue-tinted bug from Dodge County, wondering what it was.
So, without seeing the size reference, I can tell you, I know it's a thread-waisted wasp. Sphecids are the fancy names that we use for them. This one, I think, is the cricket hunter, but I can't tell. The cricket hunter is the biggest one of these dark bluish metallic ones that we see. And as the name implies, they go out and catch grasshoppers and crickets, dig a hole, put them in the ground, lay their egg. And so there really isn't a wasp nest, per se, when you think about, yellow jackets and the like. Now, there are some smaller species, and that's where I'm having this size reference, but it's kind of the same thing. If they're not feeding on crickets, they are basically predators on some other insect. And most of them are rather species-specific. Very non-aggressive, although if you had a female in a confined case, could she sting? Yes, but that's not their nature.
Not their nature. Okay. Jerry in Bark River, Michigan has a question. Hi, Jerry.
Yes. I've been gardening for years, and I have like 3 gardens, and my problem is with potatoes. Now, I have infestations of Colorado potato beetles, and I try to rotate my potatoes, but now they seem to have found every place that I try to garden potatoes. So I just wonder if you have any remedy for getting rid of them.
Okay. This is an interesting one to me because as a graduate student here, if you told me to find a Colorado potato beetle, I would have found it quite difficult. And even though we've got big potato growing areas in the state, this insect, even though it is relatively native to North America, not Wisconsin, but kind of disappeared for a long time. But then it came on gangbusters, and one of the main reasons it has developed resistance to a whole lot of treatments. So it's been concern on a commercial basis on how you fight the fight. But I go back to I do not have stock in this company, so don't. But it turns out, again, this organic product, the spinosad product, that is out there is quite effective. It's good on caterpillars. It's good on beetles, not so good on aphids. And so this would be a product. But the strategy, rotation works for some insects. But what we find with Colorado potato beetles, they feed on various weedy solanaceous plants. So there are always reserve plants that are available. And once they get into the neighborhood, they seem to be there. They overwinter as adults. They come crawling in. And when your potatoes are just starting to come out of the ground into later June, that's when the first wave adults are coming. that's when you want to shut the door. So if you spray the spinosad when you see the first sign of adults, that should take care of it for you. Don't let it go to the end of July.
Ken, well, of course, in Jerry's case, he's probably planting a lot, but I know just myself, I've had luck in various containers growing potatoes and even in straw bale.
Yeah, and the one thing, too, is sometimes you can see where the wave's coming from because they're coming from leaf litter and other things, and you can literally watch them march in. Some of the guys out in New Jersey had done some experiments where they put trenches, and they had the beetles fall into the trenches, and then they would treat them with soapy water and kill them that way. And so you can play around with it, but you know, some of these things are kind of labor-intensive, and as I said, to me, you've got that early window when you know the adults are coming and starting these two generations that this thing will go through. The problem when you let it go later is, again, like these other insects, you've got too many life stages, you've got things that are burrowed in the ground that aren't available, and that's why treatments appear less effective because they're not all available when you treat.
Yeah. And we had a photo from Michael of some white insects, or it looks like they're white.
Those are woolly aphids. And these white strands you see are literally a waxy secretion that they have. The most common one is woolly alder aphid, but I can't tell for sure which this is. But they're just phenomenal little critters, kind of like cotton candy, it reminds me. In fact, when they have wings, that's what it looks like, little pieces of cotton candy going through.
Phil Pelletieri, our guest today. Phil is an entomologist, of course, distinguished faculty associate emeritus, former head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, retired in 2014, but he still comes by every couple of months to talk with us about insects. He's going to be with us up until 12:30 today, so I hope you'll stick around. We're going to take a look at the news, weather. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back with Phil. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at the world of insects today with Phil Pelletieri, retired UW Extension entomologist. Great to have him with us. And we will go right to the phones and take some callers who've been waiting a bit. Pam and Nakusa up next. Pam, thank you for calling.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to share my experience with Japanese beetles. I've been spraying my fruit trees with Carolyn clay, and that takes care of the Japanese beetles. They don't, if I spray before they ring the dinner gong, I don't have the problems with Japanese beetles.
Oh. Yeah, no, there is always more than one solution. And my question, do you have any difficulty with getting the spray on? Is it kind of temperamental, or does it work pretty good through the sprayer?
It works pretty good with the sprayer, and I also put a sticker spreader in with it when I'm spraying.
Yeah, and then that makes sense, too. Yeah, and again, I think it goes back to what we had talked about, the beetles start on something, and both the volatiles from the injured leaves and the females attract. So if you can shut the door early, they probably find someplace else to go. And as I said, they continue to gang up on those other plants. And so I thank you for sharing that. It is somewhat of a novel type of treatment, but really very effective.
And thank you, Pam. Appreciate it. So Carolina clay. And then she used, what did she call it?
Spreader sticker, which is basically, as the name implies, it keeps it on the leaves longer, and so it holds up against rain and the like a little bit better. Hmm.
Thanks, Pam. Kim in Eau Claire, your turn now. Hi, Kim.
Hello, how are you?
Great, appreciate your call. What's on your mind?
Stink bugs.
No, oh, got them in the house.
They're in the bathroom ceiling fans, both bathrooms. They're in the skylight, the bathroom, and the kitchen. I think they're in the attic now, and they probably came in through the soffits. We don't use that much mulch around the house. You know, and people said get rid of the mulch. They're probably living in that. No, they're living in my attic. They come crawling every evening and share our food with us, and we always have, like, five, maybe seven or more crawling across the ceiling, dropping down from in the skylight. We have covers on the inside of the house on the skylights. so the warm, moist air, you know, the it's like a plexiglass.
Yeah.
At the ceiling level, so the warm, moist air doesn't go up into the ceiling light. But they just, like, they all hang out there. There's 10 or 15, and we clean them, like, once a week, and they, I thought they were dead. They are not dead. The house warms up to 70, and they are just, like, moving around all over.
Yeah.
So, you know, with the pattern, I think you're on to it. There's something going on both with the attic. So if you get access to the attic, I would check your attic vents that the screening is small enough that they can't squeeze through there. But the other problem, even in new houses with a lot of these soffits, the way that the little plates and stuff sit, there's usually a seam. And these things are very good at squeezing through things. And so it may be worth trying to go up there and caulk that in a way or stuff it with a product so that they can't get access. You know, your vents, again, I mean, you make sure that the fan vent is screened properly and also that even where it fits, that all those areas are caulked because these are so good. And in general, most of the insects that come in the fall tend to go to the sunny sides of the house. So you concentrate on the south side and the west side more in the afternoons, create the conditions. In a lot of these insects are using visual cues. That's how they find your house. Mulch has nothing to do with it. I mean, if your house was in the middle of a woods, you'd probably see less of them because they can't find it. That's the same thing with cluster flies. That's the same thing with Asian lady beetles. But if you can spend the time and solve the riddle, you know, as I had mentioned before, no good spraying now because the ones that are in your wall voids will not be affected by the spray and then they'll just come out. So you might as well suck them up with a vacuum cleaner or whatnot. But you got till next fall to solve the riddle and stop this from happening the following year. You will continue to see them for the next 2 months. So that's predictable until it really gets warm enough and they all wake up and either they have already died and didn't make it, or again, they warm up and they move out into the green space.
Thank you, Kim. Good luck to you. Appreciate your call. Roy in Platteville, it's your turn. Hi, Roy.
Hello. Yeah, thank you for taking my call. Last year, we had moths in our pantry, and their larva would be in there, too. It must have been some organic rice or something I bought.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, they were persistent, very persistent. In fact, so much that when we thought we got them out and cleaned it and got them all, this winter, we're seeing them in other parts of the house.
Mm-hmm.
Not the larva, just the moth, the flying.
Okay, so I'm going to relate.
Get rid of those.
Yeah, so I'm going to relate my problem with it's usually Indian meal moth. And in our case, it came in on birdseed, which was more common. The birdseed manufacturers have went to great extents to try to lessen these problems. But then they got into our kitchen cupboards, and we went through, we threw out what was infested. We put other stuff in basically moth-proof jars that we'd have around. And I had the same dilemma. You know, I would see one moth a week or so, and my wife was teasing me more than I deserved it. That's probably the best way to put it, of why I couldn't solve the riddle. And I knew that there had to be another food source. And so anything that's dried plant material is a food source. And so I was just looking. We had an old bird cage downstairs. I thought, well, is there some bird seed there? No, that wasn't the problem. And what finally solved the dilemma is I found a package of a hardware store bag that I would have swore I had screws or nails in it. And it was a package of dried vegetable seeds my father-in-law had given me years before, and I forgot about it. So with the pattern that you're seeing, it's not the kitchen, it's elsewhere. You might have a Christmas wreath made out of, walnuts or the like. You might have a dried flower arrangement. I even pick on, when the kids are in kindergarten, they often make these flower paste art things, and you bring it home and save it because, again, it was their first picture. Flower-based dried stuff is food sources for Indian meal moth. And so you got to start poking around and use this hint where the moths seem to be more frequent to tell you if it's always your bedroom, then it's worth going in the closets and lifting up boxes. One other source is old mouse bait. The poisons that are in mouse bait, honestly, do not affect insects. And so somebody threw a pack of mouse bait back somewhere years ago. That could be the kind of food source they're looking for. And usually the numbers, if it's a low trickle, it's something relatively small. if you get this big explosion, they found something new. And that's the biggest frustration, is if you have other things, you know, popcorn or whatnot, that's not sealed properly. If a moth lays her eggs there, then you've got another hot spot. So it's all about, you can't spray for them. You basically got to hunt them down.
And Roy, thank you so much for calling. I appreciate your call. Larry in Menominee, we'll go to you next. Hi, Larry.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
A number of years ago, a friend of mine gave me some potatoes, which are very excellent, and he said that the Colorado potato beetle will not bother them. Well, I planted them next to reds. I think I had Kennebecs and probably some russets. I planted them in the garden, and it was the only potato, which was an excellent potato, that they did not bother. And since then, I mean, I've given them to friends, and I can still get the seed. I don't plant potatoes anymore, but I've never been able to find those in any catalog.
Interesting. Well, the only thing, in you do see differences in different varieties as far as their susceptibility. Now, back when, maybe 15 years ago, there was some genetically engineered potatoes that if the Colorado potato beetle ate it, it would die. And the protein that was used for that is an organic product. But when you start playing with genes, then all of a sudden it gets into a different world. But they were Colorado potato proof, but the product was taken off the market. Just for sales, and I think some of it, again, just public concerns, because a lot of people are not comfortable with that technology. But so that's my first thought is if you still have a strain that has this BT built into it. If not, did you know the variety? Did anybody ever tell you what it
was? Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Yeah, did anybody ever tell you what the variety was?
No, that's why I was looking for something again. Mm-hmm. And to find out what it was, but I know a friend of mine still plants it, and if I need the seeds, I can get them and plant them. And again, nothing touches them.
Yeah, I'm just a little curious to have that night and day effect, that if this is not, again, some of these genetically modified potatoes from back in the day.
Or it could be an old, heirloom potato. The reason I bring that up is because on Friday on Garden Talk, we've got a guy from Missouri, and I'm forgetting the name of the seed company, but he works in heirloom seeds, and I know from listening to him talk that there are some heirlooms that can be effective against, bugs won't touch them. So, Larry, I'm going to tell you should tune in to Garden Talk on Friday and listen, and maybe call in and bring this up again, or I'll try to remember to bring it up, and we'll see if we can get a name if he has an answer to that question as well. So there you go. Thank you so much for calling. And by the way, you can join in too. Open lines get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234. Baker Seeds, Jill tells me, is the name of the seed company. So Baker Seeds, the rep from there will be on. Jan called to remind us that bindweed is very invasive, and we had a caller earlier using bindweed as an attractant to
Japanese beetles,
so you need to watch out for that. And then Daryl emailed to ask you to spell the name of the spray for raspberries.
Okay, so the active ingredient you're looking for is S-P-I-N-O-S-A-D.
Spinosad.
And again, it is an acceptable organic product. But as Ed mentioned, caterpillars really good. Beetles, kind of good. I mean, it's pretty good. But some of the soft-bodied insects, it really does not have a strength for, and so it doesn't cover all the bases.
So S-P-I-N-O-S-A-D. O-S-A-D. All right, there we go. A caller also wondered about or mentioned that he went from red to black raspberries and didn't have any problem with Japanese beetles. They didn't like the black for some reason.
Yeah, I said the whole preference thing is really quite interesting. I mean, even with roses, because roses are highly susceptible, you see differences in color, leaf texture, those kind of things that do play into, because again, the insects are using visual cues that we don't see. They have a different spectrum of light that they see, and in trying to understand that dynamic sometimes helps us in breeding purposes of how we can breed plants that are less attractive to insects.
Well, let's take some more calls. Again, you can join us at 800-642-1234. Give a call. Angela in Rhinelander, we'll go to you. Hi, Angela. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I'm calling about earwigs on my milkweed plants. I have recently, or this last year, had a bunch of milkweeds in my yard to lure monarchs, and it apparently also lures earwigs, and they're my most feared bug ever. So must they, do they come with a package, or can I separate them?
Well, the one thing, you know, I think there's a real reason, aside from people being disgusted about earwigs, I have read papers where earwigs will prey on young monarch caterpillars. So, you know, they're a nighttime feeder, both on plant and insect material. I used to say they're like goats, they eat anything. And I had a person in the audience that was very offended. She kept goats and didn't think that was a fair statement. So I tried to back off that. But the deal with earwigs is, they come out of the ground as half-grown critters, usually the first week of June. And then they are hiding during the day. And I guess I'm, you know, at this time, the milkweeds are pretty small. But if you start noticing activity, I would never spray the plant. I would spray the mulch area around the plant, because that's really where the earwigs are doing most of their hiding. And I think that's a way that you can reduce the earwig numbers, but you're not getting your monarchs and the like exposed to stuff, because everything there is going up above ground. So, you know, the strategy is there. And I honestly think they probably don't really get into it and the plants get bigger. So this is another one of these cases of heading them off at the pass early, I think can give you long benefits, because there's only one generation a year, and everything you see all summer basically was part of this one generation
and,
that was going
when,
to the ground.
So then timing on that?
I would say the first week of June.
Okay.
Even though the mothers are raising their young in the ground earlier than that, as I said, they don't come out until we at least get to the holiday, and then usually the next couple of weeks after that. And then their numbers will ebb and flow depending on moisture levels. You know, wet years, they're much happier. Very dry years, they're not. But if you got a lot of mulch in the garden, you're creating a better habitat for the earwigs to hang out in.
And, of course, last year we had lots of water in most parts of the state, although Rhinelander, I can't remember if Rhinelander had that much. It had its
Yeah,
share.
I think enough in you know, earwigs, I remember, you know, when I first started coming on the show, we only found them in Milwaukee, and being as wise as I am, I said, well, maybe that's the lake effect, that they could only survive the Wisconsin winters, and of course, they got to Madison, and they've marched up to Ashland. It just took them probably about 20 years to move through the state.
Thanks again, Angela. Appreciate your call. And let's take a call from Georgie in Madison. Hi, Georgie.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've been trying to figure out these dust mites, and some people call it, oh, they're just minuscule. You don't see them. But I feel the effects, you know, like itchiness sometimes. And I try to use the Actimine and dusting, of course. And there's a site where it says pull back your covers, and I got an air purifier. And then I came across this site that said use eucalyptic oil and tea tree oil in water and spray the area, you know, especially after you just vacuumed it. So I wondered if there's any other. I'm waiting to see, you know, it's just constant upkeep. Yeah. With them.
Yeah. Okay, so the thing about dust mites, why they are concerned to humans is basically the allergy, you know, in that even dead dust mites and their waste causes allergy-like symptoms. They are not a biting mite. They're not a mite that lives on the skin, but they do live on the skin flakes that come off people. And my one concern about what your strategy is that the more moisture there is around, the better the mites do. And by spraying anything that's adding moisture to the environment, to me, is going the wrong direction. And, you know, usually what the suggestion is to have things easily vacuum cleaned and not dust collecting. The more stuff that you collect, dust gets more of the waste and other things, which keeps more of the stuff in the environment, which causes more of the irritant. If you're getting the biting sensations, boy, I would, you know, look into what other irritants might be responsible, because they said that's not what dust mites are about. It's more the you know, the runny nose, those kind of symptoms.
Yeah.
That you associate with allergies.
All right, there we go. Thank you, Georgie. Appreciate it. And Kathy in Hartford, we'll turn to you. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, I have another question on Japanese beetles.
Okay.
They've been my nemesis for at least 10 years, and like you said, I do live close to a golf course. And I don't take meticulous care of my lawn or anything. I have creeping Charlie, all kinds of stuff, and we just mow it. But it's been so bad sometimes that they get my grapes terribly, and then I suspect they fly down and go in my grass, and they actually have been to the point of killing my grass. But my question really is if they tend to gravitate from golf courses, they want their stuff all pristine, and that don't they treat for the grubs?
They do in high-value stuff, in greens and teas.
Trees.
But when you start getting into the fairways and then the roughs in particular, it just, you know, it's too expensive to treat it. And so that's where you see the dilemma is areas that are irrigated that are not at high value. Greens, of course, honestly, they're not as common on bent grass as they are on bluegrass and fescue. And so that also helps them a little bit. But, it was a dilemma when they first moved in the state. We're trying to solve the riddle. And we thought the winters would keep them out. Well, they survived 30 below. But then the level of moisture in the spring and especially the summer, if you have dry late summers, that's why in most of our lawns, they don't do very well. They die out. But that goes back to the golf course. There's never such thing, you know, because they're irrigating all the time. It's always the ideal conditions. Now, we know what seems to happen in the good side of things, that there are some diseases that move in that help knock the grubs out over time. And so I'm hoping that that will be one of the blessings. But, you know, in some cases, you know, I do know of people that say they just never seem to go away.
And there's, I'm just thinking about golf courses. I know like birch trees on one of the courses where I play from time to time, they do a soil spray, I think, that goes up into the birch itself, and you can see them just dropping like flies, so to speak.
The same chemical we're using in emerald ash borer is a way of keeping the leaves on various trees. The one tree we don't do that anymore on is linden because of the bee issues, and so that it's not even legal to use that anymore, but that is a way of keeping it on some things. And honestly, those products do have registration on raspberries and like, and you follow label directions if you're inclined to use chemicals and have to wait, I think, 20 days before you can harvest fruit. But that does make a difference if you're inclined to use, but you got to put them on before the wave comes.
And someone else wondered, and you've kind of addressed this, but the polar vortex, wondering if it had any impact on the insect population.
Yeah, things that are exposed. So again, scales and aphid eggs and the like, I can see it having an effect. But anything that's on the ground level or below that has the insulation and living in these microenvironments, not. What I always tell people is that, I find the spring weather has more of an effect. If we warm it up and then slam the door, then you see a lot of mortality. But in general, winters don't have. And the other thing that I always used to factor in, although winters don't kill mosquitoes, it's kind of the other side. What's going on now with as much snow as we have suggests to me that we might be prone for spring flooding. If we get spring flooding, we're going to have lots of mosquitoes.
Lots and lots of mosquitoes. Well, the only other thing that, in just in terms of lots of, I know Matt in Wausau was worried about the number of insects in general.
Yeah. This goes back to, you know, we used to talk on the show, people would call in and say, I don't kill as many bugs on my car. And, you know, we were thinking about all kinds of things. But now the data suggests there is a mega problem going on worldwide. Insect populations are drastically, and it's a combination of land use changes, climate changes, insecticides. And so if you seem to see less bugs than you did, that's what everybody's witnessing. And there's definitely science. Good article in the New York Times back a couple weeks ago, if you want to get into depth on this.
And on that happy note, we're out of time. Phil, you're back on April 17th.
Sounds good.
We'll do this all over again. Phil Pelletieri, Distinguished Faculty Associate Emeritus from the UW-Madison Department of Entomology, our guest. He's back on April 17th. Tomorrow, we'll talk about the difference between synthetic and, I forget what we're going to be talking about tomorrow. I think it's car care. I think it's auto care. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Stay with us.